Hello, everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I am one of your hosts. My name is Jess Geyer. I write tabletop role-playing games, and I'm one half of Wannabe Games. And someone give me a name. I need a name. A name.
Earl.
Oh, was that Craig? Craig,
Earl?
Craig Campbell?
Oh, that's
Craig Campbell.
That's how you're passing this thing off now? That's the new thing? We had no pre-production meeting. I am very, very upset with your lack of professionalism for this very, very lucrative podcast that we run.
I can't believe that you're not yes-anding me right now.
Oh, because of what we're talking about. Anyway, I'm Craig Campbell. I'm the owner of Nerdburger Games, and I make role-playing games as well. And we are here with a longtime guest of ours who is back once again. Hello, Sarah. Welcome aboard again.
Hello, hello. Thank you for having me.
Sarah, tell us about yourself.
So I actually have an update since the last time I was on this podcast. Ooh. Is that now I am Dr. Sarah. I defended my
doctor!
PhD. Finally!
Dr. Sarah!
And
you outrank me! I have a master's. I never went to a doctor.
Okay. That's good. That's fine. Unless you really want to go for the PhD, there's no reason to go for the PhD.
Yeah, in architecture, there's no reason to go for a doctorate unless you plan to teach.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that's an interesting
master's, however, is typically required for license.
But most of my time is in higher education right now, and I'm actually really enjoying it that I'm no longer paying tuition or working on a terrible adjunct salary. So I can actually do tabletop games without them having to make money, which is a really, really wonderful experience. So that is where we are at right now.
Yay.
Excellent. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
You successfully defended your thesis, I take it, and here you are.
I did, yeah. I need to buy a sword about it.
Mm. Well, doctors, swords, podcasts.
It sounds like we're
doing an improv scene up here on the stage. It sounds like we're doing some sort of really bad segue.
So it's the show.
Sarah. Thank you for coming on, because I didn't thank you yet. Craig, what are we talking with Sarah about?
We're talking about improvising. We'll talk a bit about improvising as a GM, which is a valuable tool, although certainly something that you don't have to do. You can do a great deal of preparation. Many GMs do. But improvising can be very handy, and there are even a bunch of GMs out there who like planning, that's for suckers, and they improvise everything, and that's easy to do and hard to do depending on circumstances and what game you're playing and how much experience you have, and there's a lot of things that go into it. So we're going to talk about improvising, and then I think we'll hit a little bit on how you might, as a designer, encourage improvising in gameplay and how you can present that sort of information and encouragement to players when they read your game design.
Sarah, I'm curious why you chose this topic.
I chose it because it's something that I think people are really intimidated by, or some people are, I should say.
Sure.
Some people really are, as you, to your point, Craig, really comfortable with it, but some people find it very intimidating. And I think there's something interesting. It's not necessarily an all or nothing kind of situation. You don't have to love improv and improv all the time. You don't have to plan everything and hold it really close. There are a lot of spaces in between that people can play in that are a lot easier and a lot more fun. I think we saw in our little segue that improvising out of just a total vacuum is actually really, really, really hard. And even like professional like improv folks will do some kind of game or some kind of like prompt from the audience. You're not ever starting from nothing. And I think that is an interesting place to discuss kind of what are the tools that are out there to make improvising less blank page scary and more accessible and more fun when you're at your table.
Sarah, I found that to be incredibly easy, actually. That wasn't awkward at all, and it was very smooth.
So smooth. Well, you're a professional.
And then I was oblivious to what Jess was trying to do.
Which is why it was fun to me. That's why it was fun.
That's fair.
I totally like I am on the improvisation is scary camp, for my own reasons, which I will get into. But I think the thing that I know a lot of people are afraid of is when there are a lot of really good natural improvisers out there who just make it seem so easy. And Sarah, I'm so glad that you pointed out that it is not easy for these professionals either. They also need some of those guidelines. So I'm really interested in hearing what we all have to say about that in terms of our GMing, so we can maybe bring some of that magic and maybe make people impressed with us.
Yeah, I think there's one of the things that typically makes improvisation seem easy for those GMs that we see doing it seemingly so easily, and particularly in actual play videos, with, you know, there's a lot of GMs out there who are running long-term campaigns, and they're like, everything seems like it's this free-flowing thing that they're kind of rolling through. But oftentimes those people have done things in the past leading up to that where they've studied improv in some capacity. They've taken classes, or they've worked in the theater, where they, you know, worked, or, you know, just as a hobby, been in the theater and had, acting exercises where they had to kind of improvise a scene with your scene partner and things like that. And they've spent a lot of time building those skills to the level that it looks so easy. But in their head, they are remembering the lessons that they've been taught over the years. And they're thinking that maybe not, consciously, but they're thinking about, they're drawing upon their experience of learning how to do all of these sorts of things in all this bag of tricks. When I did a lot of improv at the Bristol Renaissance Fair, one of the things we talked about was having your bag of tricks, your bag of bits, which is, just things that you can bust out at any given time. That's like, I've got this hook that I can just jump into, and I can go off on that, and I can take it down whatever roads, because I've got, like Sarah was talking about, prompts, things to start from. And there is, it's very easy to get intimidated by seeing that happen. And when you're put in the position of having to improvise, when you're not terribly, comfortable with it, it becomes a very inward focused thing where you're thinking about, am I going to be embarrassed? Are they going to think that I'm doing a bad job? Am I going to, do this poorly? And you get kind of inside your own head. And there's a lot of things that we can talk about here that will help you kind of get outside of your head and just take a shot at it. And I think we maybe start from here. One of the things that you, that can help a great deal with improvisation is familiarity with your group. Mm. Like if you're the GM of a home group, or even like an at-store group or game day group, where you've got a lot of the same players, or always the same players, it may feel more comfortable to improvise, because you're dealing with people that are, you know a little bit, maybe they are straight up full on friends. You've known them for a long time. They're going to be less, at least in your mind, they will be less judgmental. They will not be worried about whether or not you're like, oh, you stumbled over something. Well, so what? We're all having fun. So that can be a good place to start, is if you're kind of trying to improvise a little bit more, is if you're in a position to have a group of players who you know, keep that in mind. They're all cheering for you. Like, those players want you to succeed. They want you to give them a fun story. And they're going to forgive, not the best word to use, but it's the one that you will think in your head when you're thinking about goofing up something. They'll go with it. They'll roll with it.
And they're more likely to yes and you to what you raised. Part of improvising is you're usually not doing it. I mean, well, you could be, but you're probably not in a TTRPG setting, just standing up there and performing your improv and everyone's sitting there watching. So there is a degree of group comfort with this. Many, many players have those skills as well. And they may not be GMing for whatever reason, but they are more comfortable with improv, and you'll probably already know which players those are. I can definitely pinpoint like the players who are like, they're totally down to take that curveball, and the ones who are like, whoa, I need a little context setting, and then we could do the scene. But if you want to improv more and there's someone in your group who's really good at, yes and them, which I realize we did not define. Yes and is just you don't deny the other person introduced to the scene, you add on to it, right? So we're waiting at a bus stop. We're not suddenly waiting in an airplane hangar. We're waiting at a bus stop and the bus is late. And it's raining. And you keep building it collaboratively. So that's what yes and is, if that was not familiar to folks. But chances are you've got a player who's already doing that. You give them something, they build on it and bop it back to you. Those are really great people to practice with.
I think that that really helps too. It helps. This might be more natural for a GM. I think a GM has to do a lot of this building, maybe sometimes on the fly, maybe sometimes not. Depends on your style of GMing. But players, I know in my experience, both as a GM and as a player, doing that yes anding can feel like you're taking control of a scene in a way that they might not be used to, even if it is welcome, even if it is something that the GM wants or the other players want. Like, as soon as I say, oh, it's raining, like, but I'm a player. Do I know that it can rain in this fantasy setting? Is that possible? And I think a lot of players will, they hit that little initial bump of discomfort. Like, I don't know if this is acceptable and possible in this world. And then they won't ever take that initiative. And I think that, like, as a GM, it is, if you are a GM, you need to create that setting for those players. Like, the ones who are really comfortable with it are just going to do it. The ones who aren't need to see some examples. They need to see that it's okay. You need to tell them that it's okay to do. Yes. Maybe even in your session zero, or maybe throughout, like, hey, it's okay to do this. I want this. We can build this together. And you have to be really, really sparing with your no's as well, because the more no's you give somebody, the less likely they are going to want to like try to do that. Adding on, sometimes you're going to have to say a no. Like, actually, if you do this thing or you say this thing, it does contradict this important thing that I have going on. Sometimes you're going to have to say no if you're a GM. You have to be really sparing with them and try to make it a no, but as much as you can.
That's exactly what I was going to point out. Yeah, give them an alternative that's in the vein of what they were trying to do.
Yeah. I mean, I know for me that's one of the biggest things. And then also, well, I'll talk about GM-less games too and my discomfort sometimes with those as well, but I play them to get out of my comfort zone. how can we build that? How can we better build that environment? Like, what are some ways that we can set them up for like little asks, little yes ands throughout? Cause I think that would help, exercise them, build them up.
I really like giving people opportunities when it's something that they do control. So, and in many TTRPGs, what they control is their character. And so if you can invite them to introduce a world detail through their character, like, do you have any family who lives in this city? That is a free opportunity. It doesn't break the world in any way, shape, or form, but it just introduces a little chance for them to say, yes, I do. My uncle lives here and he's a blacksmith. Whatever it may be. Actually, yes, my cousin was arrested for like hacking the mainframe. Whatever it can be. But you can give them a little window within something that they do control. And that works even in games that don't really embrace a lot of improvisation, because generally the place that the player controls is their character and their character's backstory by extension, but their backstory is part of the world. And when they can incorporate their backstory into the plot, that always feels really good. So inviting them to think about like, what is their character's relationship with the world and what is the knock-on effects of that in your world? Mm-hmm. I think that's a really effective training wheels on, kind of works even if you do have a more rigid plotty setting way to encourage improvisation from your players.
That's huge, as long as they haven't completely developed their backstory, maybe.
Well, yes, you do have to, that is a personal GMing preference, is please don't send me your 20-page backstory. I don't know that I want to read all of that, and the odds that you've contradicted something and you don't even know it are getting really high. Please write me a backstory that has space in it, and I can kind of yes and you back and be like, I love when players give me I have a cursed sword and I don't know what cursed it.
Ooh.
Awesome. Right. Thank you. And in like actively I ask for these I call them like knives, like things I can use to hurt your character, right? But things where there's an unanswered question or an unresolved tension, that's a really good avenue to be like, maybe even like session zero or like outside of table. I'm sorry if you can hear my dog.
I heard maybe like a little wolf, but we welcome dogs on this. I have my own dog here. He sometimes makes an appearance. No, I love the I think that those two things work together really well. Like, yeah, you and the players both need to leave room for each other in your improv. If I have a complete backstory and I know exactly everything, like, why am I not just writing a book at that point?
Yeah.
Because I'm not leaving any room for outside influence on me. And same thing for the GM's world. You can't have like this incredibly tight thing. Here's everything that's going to happen. Here's exactly how the world is. Here's all the people, because that's not leaving room for them. We need to be leaving these gaps open for each other to be influenced and make changes and be welcome to making changes too. Kind of letting go of, I think the letting go of your plans is also letting go of your own desires, letting go of your own ideas, and just accepting that, you know, we're at a collaborative place and not solo role playing. Huge stuff.
Yeah, those leading questions that, you know, Sarah was talking about is one of the things that I use all the time. And it takes some of the impetus off of the player to, like, if you just like pause and wait for them to kind of say something that's going to kind of fill in a gap or, you know, to provide some information that will be useful. They may not be sure what to say. They may not be sure that you're expecting them to say something. So a little leading question will kind of get them talking. And then once they describe a little bit of stuff, you can ask another leading question or you can pass it to another player and kind of fill out a little bit more about it. We were talking about you're waiting at a bus stop. The bus is late and it's raining. And that could be a series of questions of, that are played out to multiple players where the characters are going to ambush someone on the street. Okay, where are they going to do that? One player says, we're going to do it at the bus stop because they know they're going to arrive on this bus. And then you ask another player, well, what's complicating that situation? Well, the bus is late. So now you're sitting around here for a long time looking kind of suspicious because you're sitting around and not getting on a bus. What else makes it unique to the situation? Well, it's raining. Oh, great. Now we got visibility issues and who knows what that might mean in the game system. And you can build all that stuff just with a little ask here and there. And those are easy, you know, like one sentence answers. They're improvisation. They're, you know, the player's coming up with something in the moment, but it's a one sentence thing that it's very low risk, so to speak.
This is where having your bag of bits, I think, is really useful. If you're someone who's like, okay, but what do I say? And I think that's pretty common in GMs who really love to plan, is like the moment when things go off the rails and you just blue screen, like, what? No. And I want to start with, it's perfectly fine if you're totally lost to be like, so I really thought you were not going to do this. Can we get the pizza early while I figure out how we're going to fix this? Totally fine in like any situation. Players understand that sometimes that happens. But having a bag of things when things go off the rails like that, having a sense of, okay, what can I pull that is going to make sense in the situation that will seem like it's very logical? So, and that's part of that is, I think, genre awareness. Something that I think is really, really helpful for improvising is reading a lot, watching a lot, playing a lot of video games, because if all else fails, you can just steal. Mm. I did this when my little brother was a lot younger. We were on like a 2-hour car ride, longer, four. It was a long car ride with a like 6-year-old. Rough. So I fully took the plot of like a Dragon Age Origins mystery and like just took it wholesale because he hasn't played that game. He doesn't know. And we had a single die, and I just like used that. All right, that's a bit in my bag of bits. And it's broad enough that even if he'd been older and he had played the game, I don't know that he would necessarily have recognized it. Maybe he would have, and then it's kind of a fun callback. But that kind of genre familiarity with whatever kind of genre you're playing in really, really helps to have, oh, these are the kind of tropes that I can leverage in this situation when I have no idea what's going on. Or I know my players always respond well to a wandering stranger asking them for help. Or I've noticed that my players, if they don't know what to do next, like introducing a crisis really helps. Those kinds of things in your bag of tricks will help you not just totally like freeze up when the opportunity comes that you have to or want to create something you didn't plan.
We should always be stealing, but you know, you're the 6-year-old's gonna in like 10 years gonna go back and play this retro game and get the wildest case of deja vu.
He's a sports kid. He has no interest in this at all.
Oh, there we go. Guy. Perfect.
So I'm totally safe. He will, whatever he remembers of that, because now he's off to college, but like whatever he remembers of that, it's gonna be fun, right?
Right. I think like the genre awareness is like just knowing exactly like what kinds of things you can add thematically and story trope wise too, like definitely steal, but then you can also steal like those overarching plots. So I'm thinking like if you were playing a fantasy game, oh, Wandering Stranger is totally appropriate for something like that. If you're playing more like a Resident Evil style, like zombie apocalypse, you can do a threat, or oh, this random shack, this is actually where the secret evil lab was, because there's a secret evil lab under every building in Resident
secret
Evil.
Evil lab.
And if they didn't go to your like Craig has said this before, like oh, they didn't go to Dracula's castle, well, move Dracula's castle to the strip mall or wherever they're going. That's not exactly what Craig says, but you could, like, they don't know where you had things planned, you can move things around like that and take your little bits of planning and just improvise where you can within, as long as it's like it should still feel cohesive, which is why, Sarah, like you said, that genre knowledge is important. It should still feel like it's part of this tone, part of this style. And I think that the more you do consume of other things too, the better you will get at this. The more you'll just be able to like, yeah, this is something that could plausibly happen. Let me add this in.
To the cohesion point. And then you have to write down that you did it.
This is my problem.
Everyone's problem. You have this great idea. It introduces a cool twist. And then you forget about it because it wasn't in your notes. And then your players remember. And you've contradicted yourself. And you lose some internal consistency. Which again, forgivable. But it's stronger if you then make a little note, and I usually have a running document for whatever game I'm running that's like plot bunnies or like whatever, like jot it down that you move Dracula's castle to the strip mall. So when they say, oh, let's go back to Dracula's castle, you know that it's in the strip mall. Shockingly easy to not do that.
This is my fear when I'm GMing and I'm improvising, is that I sometimes get so caught up in the moment that I will either say in improv something that totally contradicts something I did earlier, or I'll do something and I'll forget about it later because I'm also terrible at taking notes. And that is my worry every time, which is why I plan and review my notes. If I am doing something that does involve, like, here's a plot that's lasting a long time. Like one time I improvised that, oh yeah, these two characters, they're your long lost siblings. And I was like, this is like the fifth long lost sibling I've given this character. And I'm going to have to make their dad like this huge player who's like traveled the world. So I had to like go back and figure that all out. It ended up working out because, again, they don't really know. And they're usually in the moment too. But oh my goodness. When that realization hits you and your blood runs cold, like, oh.
Where's that like viral tweet that's like, I sent my players back in time and I didn't describe the mountain, and like they described a mountain near the like city, and like my players like, oh, I'm really interested to hear what happened to that mountain. Me too, buddy. But that's part of it, right? Like, you have, even when you do contradict yourself, okay, we have a little problem, but the fixing of that problem can be where the real fascinating storytelling happens, because yeah, I want to know what happened to that mountain. Mm-hmm. I'm so invested in what happened to that mountain, which can lead to a really, really magical, fascinating plot that you weren't expecting, but can be the thing that sticks with your players years later.
You change your continuity brain problem into a problem for the characters to actually overcome. It's what you planned all along. Yeah. I totally meant for there to not be a mountain in two different timelines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, at that point, it's like, did you go back in time or did you go back in time to a parallel dimension? Mm. Like there's so many things that you didn't make a mistake. You foreshadowed a twist. Mm-hmm.
I just hit on an idea for a game where, like, it would have to be about time travel, probably. And I don't know what the players would necessarily, you know, players' characters would necessarily be doing, but you could run it completely improvised and give yourself the freedom of just like, oh, I'm going to, you know, just say that Dracula's castle's over here, and then another time I'm going to say it's in the strip mall. And the hook is, well, it was over there. And then somebody some enemy of yours went back in time and caused some change that caused Dracula to build his castle in the strip mall now. And so, your characters remember both timelines. And that's what's one of the things that makes them special. And I'm blatantly stealing that as encouraged by Jess. I'm blatantly stealing that from the Dark Tower series and Jake, the character of Jake, who remembers Roland remembers two distinct timelines of how things went with Jake, with a character named Jake, because he does one thing and then he time travels and he does another thing. And so now there's two distinct memories. And now I really want to make that game or play a game like that.
You should read to our point about stealing ideas. There is something, and I have to go through my Libby app because I never remember the title of anything I've ever read. The Space Between Worlds by Micaiah Johnson is a really interesting play on the different timelines, world jumping thing. It's a little more sci-fi than fantasy and kind of dystopian, and it's really, really good. You should check it out.
The Space Between Worlds. I'm going to write that down. Yes.
This is a general pitch for everyone. I had a great time with it. It was really, really interesting. Has fun, it's got something to say, and it's a cool sci-fi story. Very, very cool. Just check it out.
It's a similar Thank concept, you for the book, right?
Is that, like, there is always some way out of the problem that you have made for yourself if you do make a problem. And genre awareness and a well-worn bag of tricks will help you make fewer of those mistakes. But in general, you can find a solution that works within your world. Occasionally, you may be like, hey guys, I think we need to retcon because I really, that really actually can't have happened.
Yes.
And potentially it's and I can't tell you why yet.
Yes.
Your players are going to be fine with that. I promise. It's mildly embarrassing, but everyone understands what happens there. Like, you can always just gently retcon, be like, that wasn't supposed to happen.
It was a clone. It was time traveling. It was brainwashing. There's so many things.
I said I said X originally, and then I said Y. And honestly, Y is more interesting, and you're going to enjoy Y. Mm-hmm. And so we're gonna say that Y is the truth, and X is not. So just forget that, you know, and the players will be like, oh, well, okay. So they've got something planned. Like, there's something. Yeah.
Or the person who told you X was actually lying. Why were they lying about
Ooh,
that?
Yes. Rumors, especially. Yeah. Rumors. That's one of the easiest ways to deal with goofing up on an improv is if it was just something that somebody said, it was a rumor. It was a nefarious lie. And there's a reason they told you this thing.
Yeah. A commonly understood stereotype. That's not actually the case. Like, there's. Humans are also fallible in your games as well. And you can leverage that to unstick a wicket.
I think the biggest overall umbrella solution to this before we transition into how do we include the stuff in our games that we're writing or producing is that this kind of stuff does take a lot of practice. improvisation skills are not like I'm not born as an infant coming out and saying, give me a place, give me a profession.
Give me a location, a job, and a name.
Yeah, I can't. Those are their muscles, just like playing a game, being good at playing a game. I think a lot of what people think of as being good, quote unquote, at role playing is this level of improvisation that people are comfortable with and using their creativity. And it is a muscle. If you are a GM, I really, really recommend that you play some games where you as a player are required to improv, because that puts you in your player seat a little bit more. As a player, I recommend that you try GMing or play a GMless game that requires a lot of improvisation. There are a lot of games out there that built into the mechanics requests and forces you to add things, to change things without really thinking about them for too long. And those are all different ways that you can kind of stretch that muscle. And if you go to conventions, if you're into this kind of thing, a lot of people run panels specifically on, like, we're going to do some improv. We're going to do an improv class. You can find those at a lot of different conventions if you go to them. Or if you're in Chicago, you can just go take an improv class. They're everywhere here. That's not really
major cities. Yeah.
Yeah. That's not really my thing. I don't want to go out there and, improv on a stage. I much would rather have a script, just follow the script. But some people have found a lot of good use out of it. And maybe that's something you'd want to try.
I might also add in, you can hang out with kids. Because a 6, 7, 8, 9-year-old has really good improv skills. And they are totally uninhibited.
Yes.
So I do think, to your point, it's a muscle. But it's a muscle you used to have.
It's because kids are not afraid of it.
They're phenomenally creative and they are fearless.
They're not afraid of anyone saying that their ideas are bad. All of their ideas have been good so far, obviously, because they're six. Obviously, they don't have that social pressure of being like, is what I'm going to say really cool? Is that the coolest thing anyone's ever heard? Oh, if it's not cool, I can't.
For a lot of kids, junior high kind of crushes that out of you as you start to do social group type things, and you start to see social grouping and cliques and so forth. And then you start to get self-conscious, like, do these people like me? Am I cool? All that sort of thing. And so it becomes less likely that you're going to feel comfortable with that sort of thing. And so you have to kind of, like Jess and Sarah both saying, it's, you know, grow it back. It's this, you grew this ability to do this as a child. And then for a while it got kind of stunted and you didn't do it because of social pressures and your own anxiety and whatever else. Mm-hmm. But you've still got that poorly watered plant that you can just start watering again. You can just start building that back up again.
And yeah, I was going to say my high schoolers are not good at improv. They will not improv. Yeah. They will not yes and me. They stare at me when I make a silly joke.
And I'm like, something, I'm going to point this out because I found this really interesting. It's not something I personally think about, but it was because I'm not a parent and I don't work with children or work in schools or anything like that. But I saw something online that there is a tendency right now for kids, junior high and high school age kids, to go to they'll go to clubs, but they don't dance. They go to gatherings, but they don't do certain things, because in this day and age, everything is being recorded all the time, and they're very, very self-conscious about embarrassing themselves or being uncool or you know, doing something that's going to get them in trouble or whatever, because of all the social pressures that come with, like, growing up, becoming just slowly turning into an adult over the course of about 10 years. I found that very interesting that, like, there's those types of things can influence people at the table and the players as well, and can influence you as a GM. Like, if you're a very young GM, you might find yourself thinking, like, I don't want to put myself out on a limb on anything, because I've learned that when people put themselves out on a limb, they get ridiculed online. They get cyberbullied, they get recorded, and it gets posted and it gets shared around or whatever, you know, just all those different things that, you know, junior high kids and high school kids are so good at doing, because we've all been through it. There's, like, time they are a-changing, as they say. And there's things that are like that. That wasn't something I ever worried about. Like people into dances, everybody danced, nobody cared. And if you were going to be somebody who wanted to dance, there were still certain people who didn't want to. But like now there's like, you know, there's these built in fears that are coming out of kind of the world we live in.
Yeah, but I promise it's a lot more fun. It's a lot more fun when you kill the cop in your heart and you kill the cop in your head. You can just do things. It's fun. And it's really, really fun. You're going to be okay.
So what can we do as game designers or as home rulers or who are also game designers? What can we do to encourage improv, more improv in our games, encourage this like sandbox of creativity, maybe make the world a better place one yes and at a time? How can we do this?
So I've seen it done a couple of different ways. I know some systems will like mechanically incentivize it, things where the player gets some kind of mechanical benefit if they add a detail to a scene. And if the GM doesn't accept it, they get some kind of mechanical penalty. That can be a very like front, that can be like a very emphatic way. Like you will make this like a thing that is encouraged by the mechanics. Mm. But I think that's not the only way to do it. I think something that's actually very, very useful and very successful is providing, I really like this bag of bits language, so I'm gonna keep using it, providing bits for your players. I love a rollable table. If you've seen my design back from Dungeons and Gin all the way up to Advanced 5th Edition, I love a rollable table. And the more web-based tools that come out, they'll roll them for you. It's literally just hit a button and get a thing generated. I think that's a really, really excellent way of sparking creativity because you've given them a bit. There is, and it's a genre-appropriate, system-appropriate bit because you provided it alongside your system. That is such a valuable tool for me as a GM, even as someone who's reasonably comfortable with improv, to have a pre-made bit. Ooh, I love that. Please give me a rollable table.
I do a lot of LARP, which I know I said I would not want to really go on stage and do improv, but I will do a LARP, absolutely. And very similar to giving them a bit, like give them a goal. Like a lot of LARPs I play are gonna be like a single session. Here's your character. Here's what your character wants to do. Try to make it happen. Just having the one little guideline, give them like, here is what you want, or here is how you should act, can free you up because you're not as afraid to go into the deep water if you have a little buoy to hold on to. And that's something else you could do if the rolling of the table, like that's good for inserting stuff into your scene. But what about for how the characters can react and act with it? Having them think about those things themselves or build those things within your character generation. I found that to be really helpful. It's one of the things I steal from Powered by the Apocalypse games a lot are the links and ties between people. Like, here are how you do things. Here's how you know this person. Here's how you know this world.
And to that point, a single detail can be something that someone really, really builds on. I run murder mysteries for my friends because of course I do. I feel like that's very
of course.
Like that's a lot of synergy with everything else about me. And like I played a character who was like, you are a writer. And I was like, great. And that was like a very broad, you know, it's a murder mystery, whatever. But if it can get more specific, you and I made myself, I am a writer of tawdry zombie romance. Oh, now we can play that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then like that really specific detail. You have a Texan accent, but you've never been to Texas. Why? you have whatever it may be, something that's very, very specific about the character. They are very old and they talk very slowly. Some kind of little detail. You don't need that much to make it feel like a very embodied character or a very embodied world. I really think that people can only retain like three or four things about a setting or a character or whatever you've introduced. So make them three or four really good things, and it'll feel like you have everything figured out. And I think that applies to when you design, you can, if you can give those a handful of things or encourage people to create a handful of things, it doesn't have to be a whole, to my point about backstory, it doesn't have to be a whole thing, but give them like a motivation and give them a quirk and give them a secret, and that'll start to feel like a fully realized thing pretty easily. And the more you invite that, the more I think you invite the creativity of coming up with everything else that surrounds that.
That's huge for a GM too. I know we're out of the GM, strictly GM advice, but giving your NPCs one of those things, like, oh yeah. That helps a lot too. I mean, it's also the power of a prop. You know, yeah. You get a little prop and you're good to go.
Yeah, and I cannot overstate, like, I think specificity is genuinely your friend here. I think sometimes when we think about creativity, we think about broad, like, do whatever you want. Actually, no, do what you want within a really specific restriction, and you'll feel so much more creative. In art, it's like, do something with a medium that's, like, really limited. Wow, you're going to have something that's very creative. Do something that's a subject matter that's really specific. You're going to have to get creative. The more specific, I actually think, the more creativity, and that's unintuitive to a lot of folks. But to my point, like, you have a Texas accent, but you're not from Texas. That's specific as heck.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, do you have to get creative to figure out why, right?
And I think, and it would give me an excuse to have a bad Texas accent, which is what I actually want.
which is different from just doing what you think is a good Texas accent and then doing it in front of a person from Texas who will tell you that your accent sounds nothing like a Texas accent, because that is a thing in the U.S. that drives me up the wall, is everybody saying this regional accent. Well, this character was supposed to be from Mississippi and they didn't sound anything like they were from Mississippi. And I'm like, oh my God. Anyway.
If you're a blockbuster movie, sure, I care. Otherwise, let me live.
And one of the things that I like most is to do to encourage that sort of thing is, it's subtle, but it gives the reader permission, so to speak, which is to provide examples of the, you know, improvisational thing, whatever sort of improvisation you're looking for from the players and the GM of the game you're designing, is provide examples of that in the text of the game. If you do an example of play, you know, where you've got like four pages that kind of outlines a scene and has the players talking to each other and they're talking in character and they're making roles and doing all the things, right? It's like, this is how the game is played. Well, then have the GM prompt the players for those with those leading questions and have, you know, make that part of the game, example of the game. And one thing I've done with Good Strong Hands, very specific choice on my part, was every adventure has kind of on the first page of the discussion, you know, of kind of setting up the adventure, is like a list of 3 to 6 leading questions that the GM is encouraged to ask the players to fill out details about things in this adventure that ultimately don't have, they don't have mechanical consequences. They don't, you know, it's not going to skew the adventure into something else, but it's something that fleshes things out and gives the player a little bit of ownership, and they feel like they've contributed to help make the thing. And I did that for Good Strong Hands because I wanted the players to help build the world because they're trying to save it. And it's helpful to feel like you had a hand in something and you're saving this thing that you helped create. But it's definitely, you know, it's an encouragement. It's something that shows the players, like, oh, this is, or it shows the GM when they're reading it, reading the adventures, is like, oh, this is something that this game wants me to do. You know, you might have to be kind of choice about how often you call for something like that, where how often you provide examples and how prevalent you make the improvisation kind of thing happen. Because, I mean, with Good Strong Hands, it was easy to have that be there because in the game, the GM doesn't roll any dice. So the GM is just doing story and just kind of weaving things together and telling, building up story and telling thing, you know, setting up challenges and resolving and guiding the characters and the players And so that's another thing to do, but they don't have to roll dice. You don't have to do stat block prep. They don't have to go looking for stat blocks or something. Mm-hmm. So it's another little thing that they can do. So that's, I think, useful too, is if you've got this incredibly crunchy game, pick and choose maybe how you're going to call for improvisation, because the crunchier, the more robust the game system is, it might not deal well with things that are suddenly improvised that might have mechanical implications, because the game is balanced a certain way and just give it some thought. And that's one of the things that I talk about when it comes to designing all the time, is to be intentional about things. And like when you make a decision to have this rule or to provide this example or whatever, is like, just give it a little bit of thought. Like, why am I providing this information to the reader? Because everybody who reads this game, and here's hoping that everybody who buys it reads it, right? Everybody who reads this game is gonna read this part, because everybody that reads the book reads the whole book, right?
Definitely doesn't just skim and steal.
But for those people who are going to read that part, they're gonna get they're gonna understand your intention. And that doesn't mean they have to do it. You can be prompted toward doing all this improvisation with the game text, and you as the GM or the player, you don't have to do that. But it helps as the designer to kind of put it in there if that's your intention, and then just provide it as an example.
You can also, speaking of things that you can add into your game text, we talked about retconning. There are some games that specifically include, like, hey, if you didn't like this, you can speak these magic words, and then it didn't happen, and you can start over. There are even safety tools, like there's the pause, rewind, fast forward safety tool, and you can apply that to the actual content of your game, not just like stuff that we traditionally think of, like, oh, this needs like a safety tool. Like, it can be literally for your safety tool can be used in a variety of contexts. Including a tool that allows players to, or the GM, to redo what they just did, or say, like, actually, I didn't mean that, or I didn't like that outcome. That's not what I was expecting. Can we try that again? Having those tools built in will make your players feel more comfortable with improvising and will make the game less sucky in a lot of ways. I hate the you said it, so it's happening. That's the fastest way to get me to stop playing your game. Like, if you're a GM and you say, like, oh, you said it, so no takesies, backsies. No, I'm done. I don't want to play with you anymore. If we're doing no takesies, backsies, I'm just going to go play with a 6-year-old. who's no takesies, backsies.
Way of playing.
I hate that. I hate it, and I've encountered it. Oh, yeah. So I think having a takesies, backsies is okay rule. Having that, again, explicitly outlined in your text can help, especially if you have a high improv game.
I think it really helps. I think it fundamentally comes down to your game needs to have the license to improv, some kind of clear invitation that, yes, this is a game where improv happens, and here is how it happens in the ways that, to your point, will not break the relative crunchiness of your system. These are the mechanic supported ways in which you improv. So that explicit license, here is how I, the designer, want you to improv, and where and when. And then the tools to help you improv, which is the examples of how that looks in play, or the rollable table, or maybe like some specific mechanic that says, this is the incentive to do this thing, mechanically speaking. Those, I think, are all like tools, but you have to have the invitation to use those tools and then provide some tools. Because if you have the invitation, you don't provide any tools, then you end up in the situation where the people who are comfortable with improvising do, and the ones who aren't, don't. And if you have the tools but no invitation, people are uncomfortable using them. I'm like, wait, so when and how, and are you sure? So I think that those are the two key components if you want to encourage improvisation in your game.
One of the easiest ways to call for that is just by asking a question in the text. My favorite games to role play in are the ones that have a world, they tell you a little bit about it. They give you like some structures, and then they ask you questions. Where did the ghosts come from? Why is there, who planted this tree? Who planted the world tree? They ask you questions to invite. Okay, so they give you like, okay, there's the world tree. Who planted it? Okay, now I'm being invited. I'm getting to answer some questions. I'm trying to think of the game. What game is it? There's a game that specifically says like, oh, we're not answering these questions because we want you to figure it out. And some people will play it this way. Some people will play it this way. And it just like allows you to build within that. I think if you are writing a very setting dense book, you should always leave room for those questions to trigger some interest. Again, otherwise we're playing in this very, the trick of having that sandbox be exactly like Sarah, you said, we need to have some limits. That's where our creativity is going to really flourish, but we also can't have it be so constricted that you can only build like one kind of sandcastle.
Yes.
It's hard. It's a sweet spot.
It's a sweet spot. And to your point about settings, that's a really, if you're providing a setting as part of your game, which some do, some don't, right? But if you are, I think there's, honestly, really, I've been like reading some Pathfinder stuff, and I think Pathfinder's done this pretty well, where it's like, there is a lot of lore. Oh yes. My goodness. But yes. Everything I've read, I'm like, I have questions.
Yes.
Ideas. I want to know how I can flesh this out more. That is a real art. But I think that if you're inviting that as part of, you're providing a setting, you want to invite improvisation, you have to leave openings that are productive for gameplay in the kind of gameplay that you want to create. For me, my preference is I don't necessarily want to improvise I don't want to improvise like the governance structure, but I do want to know which two council members on the council are beefing with each other, because that opens up a space for a plot, for play in the style that I want to play. If you want to encourage more of a world building play style, then yeah, leave who planted the world tree. That's a valid design choice as well, but the space that you leave shapes the play when you're creating settings. And I also want to flag, if you're a GM and you're writing your own setting, you don't have to figure it all out. Figure out the broad strokes and then say, oh, you're playing a fairy? What is fairy culture like? Where are you from? What's its geography? And then make them write it. And then note-taking, write it down so it's consistent for your world going forward.
And incorporate one or two of those things. Like, make sure whatever they provided you is something that you worked into the game. Like, your fairy character had to go back home for this celebration because it's very, very important and everybody comes back home for it because you decided that there's this particular celebration that all fairies, you know, celebrate on a particular day of the year. One of the things I did too was it's like slap in the face, obvious, but talk about what improv is. You can put it in the player section so everybody reads it. It can be something for can be GM guidance where you can maybe kind of get into tips and tricks about how you can improvise and deal with players improvising things that you didn't expect. And talk about what yes and means and how you can use no but occasionally. I've done that in multiple games, particularly GM-less games, because the GM-less games are often what we sometimes also refer to as GM-full games, where everybody's doing a little bit of the GM-type work by filling in some gaps. And I've got games that are literally like, they depend on one-sentence scene prompts, and you have to come up with everything else. So I went into 2 pages of detail talking about what improvisation is and what the rules are and how you can do it. And so that everybody has the same baseline to work from. And we don't have somebody, hopefully, that is, hopefully don't have somebody who is breaking those rules and making it more difficult for people to kind of all come together and in a harmonious way that embraces the mild chaos that is improvisation.
Yeah, that's not an improv problem anymore. That's a player problem. that requires a different tool set to handle. Do we have any final thoughts on improv?
Just that if you want to really strengthen this muscle, a really great way is to think of your second and third thought when you come to a prompt. So, oh, you're sitting at I'm gonna keep using the bus because a bus stop is a great place for things to happen. You're sitting at a bus stop and the bus is late. No, the bus isn't late. The bus came too early and it's already gone. No, I'm sitting at the bus stop, but I'm actually not waiting for the bus. I'm having a smoke break. Generating a bunch of things rapid fire that happen next without being wedded to any particular option, that's something you can do just by yourself. But the more comfortable you get coming up with those kinds of things within your genre conventions, the easier it will be at the table because you've already practiced that skill and you've gotten a little bit better at trusting what comes out of your mouth.
Practice.
Practice.
Sarah, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Sarah, where can we find you and your stuff?
So you can find me on Drive-Thru RPG. You can find me working on various level up advanced fifth edition projects. So if you like D&D, but you want something that's a little bit more independent, more in depth without necessarily more complexity, and a lot more diversity, and a lot more fun things you can do, definitely encourage you to check it out. We've got a tool site, we've got web support. It's a really, really cool system. That is primarily where I am writing. Or if you want to hear my academic ramblings, I made a TikTok like literally yesterday. I don't really know what I'm doing, but I do really love teaching and I have a PhD. So you can't tell me I'm not qualified, but the academic job market sucks and I don't want to wait for someone to hire me to do what I'm really, really good at. So if you're interested in communications breakdowns of pop culture, news media, general internet bullshit, and you want sources and you want critical thinking and you want nuance, I know in this digital age, seriously, I'm Scholar Sarah. Check it out. I'm going to create an Instagram too, but this is a new project. So I'd love to see you follow along. And if you know how TikTok works, please tell me. I feel old.
I don't know how it works, but I am going to follow you. I'm
Thank you. You're
typing
probably
it
going to be my
in
first
right
follower because
now.
I genuinely
Oh, I
just
am.
did this. You are. No. So
There's two
hopefully
Scholar
this will.
Sarahs. Are you? Wait, which one is which? No, that's you. That's a picture of you. Okay.
That's a picture of me. Yeah. Well, I was going to say it's a podcast. You won't know what I look like, but
But
hopefully
I
so.
know what you look like.
You know what I look like.
The other one's just, the blank TikTok icon. Thank you again for coming on. This has been great. You can find me on Blue Sky at Josta. I am not going to give away my TikToks. I don't really use it and I don't want anyone to find me there. You can find my games at wannabegames.itch.io. You can find me on Discord as well at Josca if you wanted to talk to me on Discord. And then if you want to find me in person, I will be in Columbus, Ohio for Origins Game Fair. Maybe you're going to play one of my games. Maybe.
And I'm Nerdburger Craig on various social medias, including Blue Sky. The website is nerdburgergames.com, and the games are available both at the store on nerdburgergames.com as well as at DriveThruRPG. And I'll be at Gen Con.
Thank
Not
you.
Origins, sorry.
Well, Origins is great. Origins is awesome.
One of
It's
these years.
that's the convention I don't work at, and then Gen Con I work at. Thank you for our opening and closing theme song, which is Avail by Steph Sax. Thank you. It's licensed under Creative Commons. Thank you, Steph Sax. And thank all of you for listening. And we'll see you back here next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.